There's a power to rallying cry that everybody in the organization understands, and everybody's running towards that one thing. There is real power to it. And even when your business is contracting, but you're all clear where you're running and all that, where you're running to will move the needle on your business profile overall.
Yep.
There's real power to it. I think people speak a lot less about that. I think that people don't talk about culture, especially in business conversations. Culture is always the last thing you'd speak of. And I feel like culture is what makes all the difference. Strategic clarity, culture. Are your people going to go to the limit to achieve what they're saying and what they're excited about? I think that there is power in just knowing what will move the needle and what matters to your company.
Explore the minds and marketing strategies behind today's winning brands and businesses. Tap into the power of the creator economy with Earned by Creator IQ. Here's Connor Begley.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Earned. I've got the amazing Oshia Savour here. Welcome to the show, Oshia.
Hi, Connor. So excited to be here.
I love when someone we're working with gets in new leadership, and it's the opportunity for me to meet somebody that's amazing. I don't know how we hadn't met beforehand, but I'm glad we've gotten to know each other now.
Likewise.
You are the chief brand officer at Mesa. I think you guys have a lot of brands that people know, but they may not know necessarily the group. Do you want to describe what the group is really quickly?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's just such an amazing company. And quite honestly, a lot of kudos to the original founders who founded it and the vision and how many times it was reinvented and where we are today. So actually, the company is 25 years old.
Oh, wow.
And it started off its roots in private label for fragrances. And most recently, about 5 or 6 years ago, we started this whole foray into launching owned brands in retailers. And the last few years, our success rate has been so amazing that we've now become the number one incubator for mass beauty. We work with the retailers, we've come up with new brand ideas, we launch them, we find sleepy CPG giant categories, either we disrupt them or we go against the grain in very noisy categories that do not have real NPD. So really, I think we take a lot of pride in finding an unmet consumer need, figuring out a disruptive mix and then launching it. That is sort of what we do and why we exist. We do have already a portfolio of some very successful brands as well, like Kristen S, Heritage by Mindy McKnight, Being Frenchy that we have with Ashley Tisdale, Findery, that's our completely owned brand. It's a fragrance brand that's exclusive at Target, Drew Barrymore's brand, Flower Beauty, that was our first foray. That was actually 10 years ago. That was like a bold move in 2013 when people were not doing it. So there's like lots of fun brands. Every day we wake up with new ideas in our minds, new dreams that we are dreaming of, and so on. So hopefully that gives you a bit of an idea what we do.
Yeah, I have a hard enough time managing one brand. Managing that many brands sounds challenging.
It is. I will not lie. It is challenging, but I love a good challenge. I would say, though, with lots of planning and prioritization, you get through it all, you know? And I think for me, that personally really works always.
What do you think is the key to success there in terms of managing a broad portfolio like that? Do you have to have strong leadership within each individual brand? How much shared leadership is there across the brands? How does that work functionally?
So we have teams that go vertical and horizontal. Horizontal would be our internal brilliant creative studio. They are so smart. Every creative, every branding, anything that you see that's comms related that's happening at Mesa and for our brands, it's coming out of the creative studio.
Yep.
So they are the team that goes horizontal. They touch every brand, every new innovation that we have. We also have incubation and innovation teams that work on NPDs, and they are also going horizontally because they work by category and they work by incubation brands that they're working on. And then we have brand hubs that go vertically. Then brand hubs have individual brand directors and leaders of those brands. And then also integrated marketing teams that do all of the social influencer and press for those brands as well. So those two teams go vertical. The other two teams go horizontal for me. And then also there's a marketing operations team as well that makes sure that at any given point in time, there's enough financial rigor that's going into it. There's a process that's being followed because, as you can imagine, the horizontal vertical can get into a traffic jam fast without a traffic manager. So that's how at least my five departments sort of work together and how I look at them as shared services, but also brand hubs and brand expertise.
Yeah, those matrixed orgs can get complex. It's very interesting for me seeing very different models because, like, you know, we work with all the different strategic players, right? So it's like LVMH is incredibly independent. L'Oreal is incredibly centralized, right? Like there's different mixes depending upon where you are. And there's other people like Estee Lauder that are in the middle. Or so, yeah, as you guys go from when you're a big company now, but to a really big company, obviously complexity increases there. So let's go back in your background. I want people to get to know who you are as well as what you're doing today, right? So you actually grew up in India and then were very successful there. So number one student out of, I don't know how you can measure to be the number one out of 6,000 students, but number one out of 6,000 at your university and then number one MBA program in the country. But then ultimately you join Unilever, you move to Singapore, then move eventually to the United States while you were at Unilever. Yeah. Was that kind of always the plan, or was that something that you said, hey, this is a new challenge, let's try a new thing? I'd be curious about that journey, as well as leaving the place where you grew up is a big deal, right? There's a lot to that. So talk me through that journey.
Yeah, no, you know, and I will tell you, it wasn't part of the plans. And yeah. I always say that when I intensely plan for something, it never goes exactly how I plan it. There's always an alternate route the universe has for me. And yet I would say I never regret, you know, because those pivots were always the perfect pivots, because otherwise I wouldn't be here and doing what I'm doing. So how it all started was that I wanted to be a broadcast journalist back in the day. And I was wanting to cover wars, and I had like a real leftist bend of mind, and my parents got genuinely worried about my sanity and where I was going, what I was going to do with my life. So they intervened and they're like, this is not how it's going to go. You're going to go do your MBA. And so is life. And so I did. And I was like, whatever, I'm on the dark side now. I live to make money. And that's all I do. You know, like my dreams crumbling and all of that happening. Anyway, so I go do my MBA and then I joined Unilever. And that is absolutely right. And that's where I fell in love with what I do. You know, they are back in the day, also 2007 when I graduated. And even so, I mean, Unilever is just so amazing. But particularly back at that time, like it was the company you wanted to work for. Like if you wanted to build a career in marketing, and especially in India, Hindustan Lever is where, if you look at the top 100 companies and you cut the C-suite and you say the alumni, I would bet 80% of them have somehow somewhere worked at Unilever at some point in time in their lives. So it's really a leadership builder and creator. So that's where I fell in love with what I do. And I learned so much from them. And with them, I went to Istanbul for the first time. And that was my first international trip all by myself. It was a 6-week stint and they sent me for a training. And it was just such an amazing experience. And then very unlike a lot of my other colleagues, I got placed in an international stint right coming out of my graduation program at Unilever. So Unilever has a graduation program, business leadership training. Oftentimes, like post-MBAs, you quote unquote go through, you rotate through different departments for 15 months before they pick you and put you in one department. And generally speaking, that first department is a sales department. For me, because I had worked before, and that's a very unusual model in how I found my way into Unilever, they put me in a very unusual career track, and that was to be sent to Singapore and in a very brand development, brand building role. And so began the journey. And it wasn't planned. It wasn't something that I ever dreamt of doing. And my parents were very progressive and they were like, sure, you've got a great opportunity. It's a great company. Go live your life. And so I did. And then luckily for me, the office was in transition. So I actually started my career in Bangkok after India for a good 6 months. And I had like the time of my life eating all kinds of street food, because that time my belly could take it. And now I'm so embarrassed. I'm like, of my whole family, I'm the first one who gets sick when I travel. But that's
when I spent some time in Thailand and ate all of the street food. There was one point where it had some issues.
Exactly. So I could eat anything. I made the best friends during that time and then moved to Singapore. And again, it was never part of the plans to move to the US. And then I met the love of my life, who I'm now married to. He's Indian American. He was there in Singapore as an expat as well. And we met through serendipitous circumstances. I guess it was meant to be. Never planned it. And here I am. In 2010, we moved here. So
there you go. What was he doing out there?
He was working with American Express. So he is in tech. And now he's like fully in financial technology and that whole space. It's actually pretty cool. But we've established in the couple, I am the cool one, even though I have a sneaky suspicion his job is just way cooler than mine.
Did he go the kind of startup route, or has he stayed at the American Expresses of the world?
He's actually now at Fiserv, which is pretty huge in payment space, payment services space. But luckily for him, he worked at a startup that they acquired. And so he was the head of their commercialization for Clover brand, which is sort of like a challenger to Square. You know, those little devices you go to, you swipe your card and...
It used to be the plug into your phone. Yeah.
Correct. All of those things. They work through all of the hardware of all of that and all of the software, all of that. And how I'm explaining it, I'm sure I'm leaving behind some very critical details and I'm super simplifying what he does. And he hates it when I do that. So let's not ask any more questions about it because I do not want to get in trouble with him.
Oh, that's awesome. You know, him at a startup. I feel like you've had a similar, right? You went to Unilever, which is massive, and then have kind of worked your way down the chain to smaller and smaller organizations, eventually to Mesa, which I think is what, maybe 400 or 500 people, something like that?
Yeah.
So considerably, I don't know Unilever's headcount, but quite a bit smaller. So two questions there. One, was that, again, intentional, or is it something you were attracted to, more of the autonomy and the control you had within these smaller orgs? And then the second one is, looking back now, if you had had a choice, obviously it sounds like Unilever was a great choice where you were, but is that corporate route the route that you would recommend to somebody just starting out in their career? Or do you think the kind of startup route would have been better if it was offered to you?
Yeah, no, I think in the end, whatever works for you, right? So there isn't a wrong or right answer to starting your career. For me, back when in 2007, I came out, like I was saying, Unilever was the mecca of marketing. Yep. Yeah. You wanted to learn marketing. You wanted to do the best in class marketing. That's where you wanted to start your career. That's where everybody studied to. They came, they picked one student from the whole business school, and it was just a highly competitive process. Fast forward, however many, 15, 16 years, things have changed a lot, right? They're still very good at what they do. They still have some of the most powerful brands, really strong marketers, still have a lot of friends there, really huge respect for the work they do. But since then, the D2C revolution happened, right? And that changed where the growth was coming from and where the market share was being lost to and where the market share was being gained. So I think it really boils down to your personality and what you want to do. If you work at a larger company, there's, of course, a lot more process, a lot more alignment you need to do versus when you're at a smaller company, you can just run with things and get things done. And there is sometimes too little process. And oftentimes where I'm finding is becoming almost my sweet spot is a company that is just at that pivot point where they're no longer that small anymore and they're ready to scale to their next billion. And that's really where somebody like me can come in who understands both sides of it, understands the process and what it takes to scale, but then also understands the nimble environment in which you want to move and be growth oriented. And you can't spend too much time debating, analyzing. Learning fast, failing fast is the way to go, you know? So I think that there is a little bit of both. And I think it really depends on what attracts you the most and where you find the most success for yourself as an individual.
Yeah. Very, very personal journey, personal choice. Yeah. And I think, again, I think both can work. I went from like a Mesa style size down to two people. And that was, you know, similar. That's about as small as you can get.
That only takes one. A very bold person. I'm wondering if that's like my next step or not, but that takes a really bold person.
I think you should. I think you'd do well. So the other really interesting contrast in your career is, so post Unilever, you went to Revlon. Revlon's had some very like visible struggles recently. I was just talking with Debbie at Revlon and, you know, they just got through bankruptcy and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. So to go from Revlon, which was having some struggles, to then Charlotte Tilbury, who might be, during the time that you were there, the fastest growing brand in the entire industry, or one of the fast top two or three, is a pretty sharp contrast to go from one to the other. So a few things. So one, what was that contrast like, right? Like, what did you notice that was different about the cultures? And then what were some of the key elements that you think led to that kind of explosive growth? Because it's pretty wild to watch.
It is definitely wild to watch. In the 2 years that I was there, it was quite phenomenal how we scaled that business. And it continues to do really well. You know, it's been 6 months. I talk about it like nostalgia, but it was literally 6 months ago when I was still there. You know, it was like, wasn't like 10 years ago or something. It was just 6 months ago. Yes, it was a sharp contrast. And I, at Revlon, while I was at Revlon, I actually headed up their prestige division. So Revlon acquired Elizabeth Arden back in 2016. Yep. So those were the portfolio of brands that I was managing. So never directly on Revlon but the prestige side of it. So I've been in prestige for like last 7 years and now at Mesa, sort of in between the mass and prestige and beautiful worlds that we exist in. So I think the biggest contrast, I think you debate a lot less.
Yeah.
You just go do it. That to me is fundamentally the biggest difference in being in a large organization where you have a lot of stakeholders. So oftentimes you keep creating a lot of PowerPoints because you want to align people.
Yep.
You want to talk to people, you want to align people. And then by the time you've aligned with these people, maybe someone else has changed their jobs or they've moved on. And now you go back again, you align here and you're like, my God, this is the... And by the time you're like literally ready to launch, it's like the ship has sailed. So I think as an entrepreneur, and I always thought of myself as somebody who was challenging the status quo, even from within. So I've always had this very urgent sense of bias of action and always just wanting to do it. So I think for me, being at Charlotte was in a lot of ways just dream come true, right? Like literally no debate. You dream up an idea, go do it. What's the worst that can happen? You fail, you learn, you move on, you know?
Yeah.
There was definitely that. And there was something very magical about the brand is that we rarely failed. And that was the beauty of it. We got so much earned respect from the industry. People would just wanted to work with us, you know? And I think that makes a big difference too, when it's not all just pay to play. Oh, if you want to partner with me, that's only how it works. And it just wasn't like that. We were a cool brand. People wanted to work with us. There was a huge partnership that we would get from people. And internally, we just had very cohesive culture. And I think cohesion is just one big thing. Is the reason why you don't debate so much is because the cohesion is there. The strategies are very clear. There's a rallying cry. There's a heart brand. And you all know what you want at the end of the day. And it was pretty simple. We wanted to be number one at everything we were doing. And so until you get that number one position, you were restless about it. And even when you became number one, you were then differently restless about it because now you never wanted to lose that position. So you kept running, even though the race was over. You're like still running and running and running and making the distance so far that the second one can never come up, you know? So, and I think for me, as somebody who's just always very inspired by growth and all of that, I think it was just exciting to be part of that culture and to be competitive, but not with a negative sense of it. You know, you're just competitive because you're running a race, even if it's a race of one and you know where your rank is and what you're going for. And you're just in competition with yourself all the time. And I think for me, that's what was really another thing beautiful that we never settled. Like we did something and even before I challenged, my team was like, oh, this is what went wrong with it. I'm like, oh my God, that's really amazing. We kicked ass with this activation. And yet you guys are coming to me and telling me this is what we could have done better. Great. Let's do better. You know, and I think it came from every level. And some of those things I think were very, very exciting and different about the company.
Yeah, there's a real art there. And I think one, this idea of fear is a real thing, right? Like, why is alignment such a big thing? There's like this fear that you're going to get in trouble, you're going to make a mistake, you're going to whatever. And obviously, trust is the counter to that, right? Like, if it doesn't work out, it's okay. Like, it's not going to be a big deal. And I think that's particularly difficult if you're to look at companies that are in contraction periods, because there is real fear, right? Like I might lose my job. And when you're growing, if you're growing at 50%, there's going to be 50% new jobs next year, roughly, right? I mean, we went through a period where we had been growing very quickly, doubling every year, double. This was like 2018. Some things happened with the way Instagram provided data. And we realized that about 40% of our revenue was not good, like not good revenue. And so we decided to cut out 40% of our revenue. Well, that's not easy to go from a company that's doubling to like, hey, I'm going to cut out half my revenue. And over the next 2 years, on a total basis, our revenue actually contracted during that time. But that 60% of revenue that was really good grew really dramatically. And so a lot of it was like shifting the attention of the organization. Like, this is what's important. This is what we're going to focus on. And this is where we can see growth, even in an environment where overall we're contracting, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's just interesting to hear you talk about it. Because again, you have to create that momentum, the excitement, all these things, even when things aren't going well. So I think we had a lot of luck involved on our end.
There's a power to rallying cry that everybody in the organization understands, and everybody's running towards that one thing. There is real power to it. And even when your business is contracting, but you're all clear where you're running and all that, where you're running to will move the needle on your business profile overall.
Yep.
There's real power to it. I think people speak a lot less about that. I think that people don't talk about culture, especially in business conversations. Culture is always the last thing you'd speak of. And I feel like culture is what makes all the difference. Strategic clarity, culture. Are your people going to go to the limit to achieve what they're saying and what they're excited about? So what you're saying, I'm really agreeing with that, because I think that there is power in just knowing what will move the needle and what matters to your company.
Yeah.
And people look towards it.
Well, and again, I think what you're saying there too is like focus, right? Like what's that one thing we're all focused on that we're driving towards? So let's talk about something that I don't know if you focused on it, but you certainly did it really well. I know you focused on it though, which is in our data, tracking Charlotte Tilbury, and specifically within the US, right? Because this is originally a UK brand. You went from our number 19th ranked brand in 2019 to then number 9, all the way up to number 2 in 2022. And ColourPop was the only one ahead of you, and you passed them this year.
Yes.
Although Rare Beauties, you know, Rare Beauties. They're now. Well, you know, they get the number one influencer in the world.
I can't feel passionately about it anymore. I need to stop. I need to.
We will talk a lot about Mesa. We'll talk a lot about Mesa. But we won't get too deep into that. But I would love to know, just when you think about philosophically, because again, they were number 19 at the time you joined. But to go from number 19 to number 2, you had to pass 17 other brands who are all trying really hard. So what I'm curious about is, what do you think philosophically worked well for you there? What were some of the tactics, whatever you feel good about sharing, that worked really well for Charlotte and having that kind of success with influencers specifically?
I mean, it starts with brand heat. Are you a brand that people want to talk about? So inherently it starts from there. Some brands are at different levels of wanting to be talkable. And I think for us, that was the advantage that we had. When I joined, which was early 2021, which is the rank that you mentioned, I think 19 was the rank. So that is the rank that we had. But when I met with a few influencers and I spent time with my team, I realized that we were sitting on a gold mine and that there was a lot of talkability and hate in this brand. And contrary to my experience, which was a very pay-to-play background, I very quickly pivoted at Charlotte. And I said that actually what's going to make a big difference to this brand is the earned piece of it. And it's the talkability. It's just how much people love us is what's going to make the difference. And I think for us also, the Madison Beer effect had just gone in. A Beauty Light once had gone viral earlier that year too. So also something to be said about just back-to-back some viral products that we had, Hollywood Flawless Filter, Beauty Light Wands, Beautiful Skin Foundation, some of those products just were really fantastic as well as they launched. So I think for us, we made some really intentional decisions and strategies towards making influencer be a huge priority. And so then from a budgeting standpoint, from ways of working standpoint, just where the priority, the mind space was going internally, those were some of the changes I made in North America. And very quickly, we started to see the multiplier effect happening there. The more we did, the more we could do. And that's where my team was just very competitive. They were very on it. And you give them something to do, they'll go do more of it and then more of it and then more of it. And it was just beautiful. It was very rewarding to see the articles that came out in WWD, which were actually from you. And oh my God, this is real good stuff. This is industry recognition. We're in the game. Like, we literally had that clipping in every retailer deck that we had. We're like, look at us doing so well. And this is like, not if we didn't pitch that article and someone else did. And this is real industry recognition. So thank you. Months later, thank you, Connor. We really appreciated that back then.
Yeah. The fun part about that is, you know, for me, I'm just trying to find the best story. Like, what's the most interesting thing that's happening? And at the time, I mean, you guys were just on fire. And I misquoted the stat. You were number 19 in 2020. So the year before you joined, you're about number 20. And then by the time you left, you were number 2. And I mean, it's just unbelievable. The other thing that I think you said in there that's critical is, so I love the embracement of earn, the embracement in relationships, budget, et cetera. The other half of the equation though is products. And I think when you look at the data, like the biggest mistake we see brands make is they get really focused on new product launches, which are important, right? Clearly you guys showed that. But the bulk of the content will be like, okay, now that we have a product that's successful, how do we get those hero products to be, you know, they end up being the vast majority of the conversation. So just love that too.
Definitely. There's such a cool part of it. And I actually kind of really enjoy reading your creator facts too, because I actually 100% agree with you that this is the new social currency and that when you're hot here, the revenue will happen. To me, the correlation is very clear to me.
I mean, it's been really fun. At some point at the beginning, you're just kind of shouting and nobody's listening. Yeah. And then, you know, a few people listen and a few people more listen. And I think the thing that I've always tried to do is like, let's try to get to the truth. And the truth being, well, how do I make decisions? It's like, well, okay, think about that, right? Like, how do I choose to buy something? And it's like, well, if somebody that I trust that's an expert in the field says, this is really amazing, they genuinely believe that, it's about as good as you're going to get. And now, because of the internet, because of mobile phones, I get access to all these experts and all these smart people all around the world that can share their opinions on things. And that's just a much better source of information than, you know, an advertisement on TV or in a magazine or on social media. It's just more trustworthy, right? It increases the likelihood of success that when I buy this, that it's going to be what I hope it's going to be. Right. And so the question becomes, okay, if that's the truth, or if that's what is happening, how do I measure that in a way that actually shows it? You chip away at it each day over 10 years and eventually you get closer and closer. So, well, let's talk about Mesa a little bit. So you're, like you said, about 6 months in to Mesa now.
Yeah.
So you're starting to get a handle on the organization. You're starting to get a handle on the team, starting to get a handle on the history of everything. And, you know, we're coming up on the end of the year. So I'm sure you're starting to think about 2024, what our big plans are that year. So what are the big plans for Mesa coming up next year? And what are some of the biggest challenges you see? Like, we really need to work through this, or this is an area where we're weak, we need to get stronger in, or this is really good, we want to double down here. How are you thinking about that for next year for Mesa?
I think where I want to take the strategy, and it's something that I always do, is to just hone in on where the magic already is and doubling down on that, and then tack on a couple of gaps that I find that there are and really building that out. So you kind of get a beautiful mix of what works, where we can take it. And so then if you're doubling down on the magic that already exists in your company, in your brand, then you amplify it with the other actions that you put out there. So in a way, like, where is Mesa's magic? It is in creativity and innovation. We are really known for it in the industry. Again, as I was mentioning, our hit rate is the highest in the industry. It is the reason why we've now become the number one incubator. And incubation is a very difficult business because the probability of success is almost 50-50. And actually, the odds in the industry would tell you it's 1 in 10 if you're lucky, right? So there are 10 brands that come out, maybe one is successful, right? And for us to have had almost 2 out of our 3 brands be successful, that's very exciting, right? Like, it's pretty exciting to get it right. So creativity and innovation is already what we are known for. So we're going to double down on it. We're going to continue to say, how do we continue to redefine creativity and innovation into the next 5 years? Like, what is our point of view as an incubator? And how do we always stay ahead of the market and the investments we need to make to make sure that that always happens? And that's what we are known for. The two other buckets that I want to add on top of is what I call talent, and then technology enablement. In terms of talent, I think as we've now spent a lot of time talking about both of our shared belief that influencer marketing is a key component of a brand success. So you can imagine that that is where a lot of my personal focus and the brand focus is going to go as well. And we actually are working with a lot of amazing founder partners as well. So really getting that rhythm with not only the founder partners and them creating a story that's compelling and putting it out there, but then also figuring out what's the UGC, what's the word of mouth, what is the content creator plan on top of that? And also our Mesa talent, right? Like, how do you continue to groom our internal talent and make them be your word of mouth drivers, right? So all of that, I think for me, that is a very key way that we're going to continue to work and do more and more of it next year. Like, we are just now at the starting point of where we need to be and where we can be as a company for all of our respective brands. And the fourth one, to me, that is the technology enablement space. That to me is almost like a non-negotiable something. It's if you're an incubator and if your job is to always be ahead of everyone else, how can we not be tech obsessed? Because beauty tech is the future, and not beauty tech in the way, oh, here's another tool and now you can do skin analysis at home. Here's another hair quiz you can do. Here's another fragrance quiz you do. It's just how we think about every action we take. And how do we become more productive? How do we become more efficient? How do we measure better? How do we use internet more powerfully in doing market research, in culture-based segmentations, in how we measure the effectiveness of everything that we do in marketing, not just sales, but also in just using tools that, for instance, Stripe has, right? Like, How do you put earned media at the center of it? And how do you measure it? How do you continue to grow it? So I think that is also just where a lot of my mind space is going to go in terms of how do we make Mesa be cutting edge also in technology adoption, and not just as a marketing gimmick, but just how we think and act and behave on the day-to-day basis.
Yeah, that makes sense. You start to get a lot of leverage if you can shift the kind of mindset internally to being like, this is where we want to be, right? So it's the tools and those kinds of things, but it's an attitude as much as it is the actual. It's like, if I'm just telling you, oh, use this, use this, use this. It's like, no. I want you to be innovative. I want you to bring new things to the table and think about how we can, you know.
Yeah.
So one other thing that I think is interesting, we'll do one fun end of show question after that. And I've never asked anybody this. I feel like I've been afraid to ask. This is like, you know, when you don't know about the clubs that everybody else is in this club and I don't know about it. I don't want to be the uncool guy that asks about it. So I don't know a lot about Chief, but I see it on every LinkedIn profile of people that I respect, right? So I'm like, this must be a good thing. And I know it's about female leadership and empowerment, whatever. But can you tell me about what is the nature of that organization? How is it attracting people like yourself and just like how it functions?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I just closed my membership, but I did join them right when they started. It was word of mouth is how I got into it. Just like you saw a couple of people that I respect share a post about it. And I was like, what is it? And I looked into it and it seemed interesting. I went and I spoke with them. It was very, very, very tight group at the time when we started. And the proposition was very interesting. It's kind of like a core group that they create. So you have about 8 women you meet with every month. Yep. They are in similar life stages you, similar career stages you, and it becomes almost kind of like a support group for professionals. You come in and you share your daily challenges, both emotionally and professionally, what's going on. And you kind of are moderated by a coach and you do exercises and you basically do self-discovery. And I would say at the time when I joined Chief, it was game changing for me because I was in a bit of a funk and I really needed to talk to a coach and find the direction of where I was going to take my career next. And it really helped me get closer to what mattered to me as an individual, where I wanted to spend the next decade of my career, and really helped me get that clarity. So that was my experience. I just now closed out my membership, but I do find that they've grown very fast. They are in many, many different locations. They definitely have a good group of women they have attracted. And I do find the people who are still there do draw a lot out of it still. So it's a great place. It's a great place to meet people and learn.
Cool. It reminds me a lot the way you describe it is YPO. It sounds very similar in terms of like the forum concept. I've had like a bunch of people talk to me about that and I haven't really pursued it, but sounds very similar in function.
Yeah.
Well, let's do one fun end of show question. I noticed as I was looking around that you used to be outside of your desire to report on politics. You did a little bit of acting too, right? Like back in school. So you were best actress a few times, won some awards in drama. Was there ever a consideration of going the Bollywood route? Was that ever something that crossed your mind? I'm curious.
No, it did not.
I don't know.
No. Not even like in like the wildest dreams. No way, no chance. The theater that I did, just for the record, is very intellectual. Almost like now that I look back, almost like pseudo-intellectual. We used to be like the Philosopher's Club. And we had like these points of view on life, you know, like we just were always the satire, the this, the that. So that was the vein I was going in. So no, I do not have any dancing talents, no Bollywood talents of acting. No way I would have failed at it. Plus, I'm also 5'2", so it doesn't help.
Oh, do you have to be tall? I guess that helps. You know, I really appreciate you taking the time out today. It is unbelievably impressive what you've accomplished both throughout your career and more recently. And I'm really excited to see where you take Mesa because I think it is just a fantastic palette to work with in terms of the brands, the technology, the infrastructure, the team. And it's something that not a lot of people have heard about, but is a big deal already. And I think it's going to become a bigger deal, particularly with you involved. So excited to watch from the sidelines. It's going to be fun.
Thank you, Connor. Thank you for having me. This was a really great conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, it was fun. All right. Bye, Ash.
Bye.
Be a friend, tell a friend, and subscribe. Earned by Creator IQ. Creator IQ is your all-in-one solution to grow, manage, scale, and measure your influencer marketing program. Ready to unlock the power of the creator economy? Get started with a demo today at creatoriq.com.